Hello and welcome to episode 182 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Cambridge, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from somewhere is Andrew Brokus. Where are you, Andrew?
I am in Catonsville, Maryland, at my mother's house.
Nice. Not the first time you've been there.
No. I get here a couple times a year, and when I'm here, I often will stay for 2 weeks around Christmas, or we might be here maybe even 3 weeks in the area this time around. So yeah, I try to make the most of these visits to the East Coast, especially now that I live on the West Coast. You know, there's a lot of people to see once I'm here, and I can always shoot over to Maryland live when I get bored of hanging out here.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So we should tell our listeners we have a little bit of a different show today.
They probably figured it out already because there was no bumper music. It just sort of came right in with you.
Yeah, which, you know, maybe that's welcome, maybe that's unwelcome, but frankly,
I think it's more welcome than me singing the music. That
I think the silent majority liked it, and the vocal minority did not. So we should let our listeners know, Andrew has been out of town, and we have had some logistical issues rounding up guests. Some of this, I think, is post-World Series fallout. Poker players are enthusiastic but hard to corral at the best of times.
No. That's 100% me. And in terms of not having the guests, we actually have a lot of people who are like, I think, you know, it's just a matter of like finding a time with them. I just haven't been available for the last 2 weeks. But I think we have a lot of people who are ready to go now that WSOP is over.
All right. Well, Andrew's calm.
I appreciate you trying to spare me the.
Right. So from my perspective, it's been sort of a combination of things, but I guess it's all Andrew's fault. And this episode is partly a result of that. It's just the two of us. We're kind of winging it. We're just recording. There will be minimal or no sound editing. So really, you get the fallibility of a live broadcast, but without any of the immediacy. And I think that's what people love about radio. So here we go.
I think this will be an interesting episode. We'll do our usual kind of like, it's not really clearing the mailbag because I've just got two questions here, but I also deleted a bunch of stuff from the mailbag that I decided we were never going to discuss. So from my perspective, we've cleared quite a lot out of the mailbag, even though in fact you're only going to hear two questions discussed.
Yeah, it doesn't mean we don't love your email. It doesn't mean it wasn't a good email. It's just not right for the show right now, or we forgot some essential thing, or it's just not the sort of thing that we're going to read, you know, today or tomorrow. And rather than maintain all the overhead and mental overhead of a large mailbag, we just decided to do a purge. But thank you for all the emails, even the ones that don't get read on air. We love you. Please keep on emailing us at podcast@thinkingpoker.net.
Do you also want people to email you about?
Yes, I do. I am a software person by day, as some of you know, and I would like to know more about the whole industry. I'm in a little corner of it here, and I'm broadening my knowledge, but I think it's not broad enough. So if you work in software broadly construed, I would love to buy you coffee, either in person in the Boston area or virtually over Skype. We'll talk over Skype and I'll send you a Starbucks gift card or something. I would really love to know what you do, what your company does, and just generally, I would like to know more about the world of software. It would help me be better at what I do, and it would help me for a lot of reasons. So if you're willing to take me up on that, if you're willing to have coffee with me treating you, I would really appreciate that.
While we're throwing ads out there, Tournament Poker Edge, of course, even though this is a slapdash episode, they're kind enough to sponsor it anyway. And you certainly should sign up for Tournament Poker Edge if you need yet another reason. I've got my latest series going up on TPE now, which has to do with defending your big blind. This has consistently been one of the most controversial things in my videos on there over the last few years is people see me call raises from the big blind with hands that they consider bad or that they wouldn't have called with from the big blind. And I'm prepared to admit that some of those calls have been bad, but I think overall I'm making money with a calling strategy from the big blind that at least a few years ago was surprising to people. I think it's gotten a lot more common now. So I talk a lot about that in the video, both, you know, why to call with certain hands out of the big blind when you're facing a raise, and also how to handle the kind of spots you get into, because I think that's one of the things that really holds people back is they're like, well, I'm going to get into some tricky spots, and I think I'm either not going to know what to do, or I'm just not going to like the spot that I'm in, and so I'll just avoid it entirely. And, you know, poker's not just about finding easy decisions. It's okay to get in some tough spots as long as you're getting compensated for it. And that's a lot of what I talk about in this series. So if you were never a TPE member, or if you've let your TPE membership lapse, perhaps this will be the video that, or the video series that will encourage you to sign up again. And of course, you can do that at tournamentpokeredge.com.
And can I say that this is actually one of the most interesting things about poker for me? I think a lot of people who listen to the show listen to it because they're interested in the game generally, and they enjoy the intellectual side of it. And I think it's really fun that, you know, just in the last couple of years, and certainly over the 12 or 13 years I've been playing, we've seen such a progression in how people think about blind stealing and blind defense. You know, for a while, people were 3xing and 4xing, then they decided to raise smaller. People, it was conventional wisdom among very good players not to defend your big blind too loose. Then more recently, people started defending with all sorts of things and deciding that immediate pot odds were more important than people thought they were. This has led to all sorts of adjustments in flop play and even in some cases in pre-flop sizing. And it's one of the really fun things about being part of poker and about being part of being part of poker is that you get to see these things evolve. You get to see the strategies evolve, and you get to see all these adjustments and counter adjustments happen. And it's a lot of fun. And it's one of the things that even people who don't want to spend 10 hours with a GTO solver can still do and can still participate in and think about. And for a lot of our audience who maybe they just show up to Las Vegas once a year, maybe they just play cards every so often, it's a good subject to think about so that they don't feel completely left behind and so that they get some sense of what the cool kids are doing these days.
Yeah, and you know, I think I know you're a little tongue-in-cheek when you say what the cool kids are doing these days, but I think there's a bit of a misconception among some people have that these are just sort of like random oscillations in the poker community where we all sort of like charge in one direction for a while and then like turn around and charge in the other direction, and that the whole goal is to sort of be one step ahead of the pack. And I think the better way to think about it is that these are like iterations that are getting closer and closer to something approximating optimal play. And so it's not, because a lot of times people are just like, oh, is this book still reading, or is this like an outdated book? And I think stuff like that, I mean, I do think there are some books that are kind of outdated, but I think the reason they're outdated has more to do with the fact that just like people have learned a lot about poker theory since those books were written, and not so much. Like, I don't think there are that many books that just assume a really exploitive approach of like, oh, everyone plays poker like this, of course, so you should play this way instead. I mean, maybe like 10 plus years ago, that's how poker books were written. But I don't think, like a poker book from 5 years ago, I don't think it's likely to be dated for that reason. It may be dated just in the sense that a lot more has been, like in the same way that like a math textbook gets dated. It's not like math changed. It's just in some cases, people, like we've learned new things about math, or maybe even just how to teach it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think in some cases, they've just been fads. And I've watched with glee as the tides have shifted and people following a certain fad have been completely lost. But yeah, no, you're right. When I say the cool kids, it's largely tongue in cheek. And I do think that we're getting closer to good play.
All right. So anyway, on to questions from our listeners. This one is coming to us from Russell. He played it at Maryland Live. He describes it as a recent hand, but I think he sent this in like March, so, you know, probably not so recent anymore. Anyway, it was a 2-5 game at Maryland Live. He said, I have about $1,000 in my stack. I pick up jacks under the gun, and for probably not any fantastic reason, I decide to mix it up and try to limp 3-bet. And then parenthetically, he adds, if nothing else, it seems better than opening $20 and getting called in 2 to 3 spots than playing out of position with a high SPR. Thoughts on, I guess, limp re-raising jacks generally, and also on that comment about, you know, if these are the choices, either limp re-raise or call and play out of position, you know, do you agree that the limp re-raising is more desirable?
Oh boy, this is a big subject. I know we talk about this with Carlos in the Coach and Carlos series. I don't, in a vacuum, I don't love this hand as a choice to limp 3-bet with. I think you get some folds when you limp 3-bet, and I would rather do that with a slightly different range. However, if you think that it's reliably getting raised behind you, then I like limping a lot of your range under the gun and re-raising a lot of it and just sort of treating it like a big blind where you get to decide whether to post the big blind or not. Like, I mean, if your opponents are going to ignore the fact that somebody has VPipped under the gun, a good way to exploit that is to just limp and let them raise to 20 with, you know, King seven suited. and then, you know, really hit them with an uppercut, with a lot of your range. So I generally limp. So it depends. This is like highly sensitive to table conditions, but I like to limp with a lot of pocket pairs, and some combinations of big pairs and ace king, under the gun, then re-raise with some of the big pairs and some of the ace king, all the ace king really that I limp with. And I like that a lot for a few reasons. People generally decide if you have it, quote unquote. And when somebody is just sort of making that kind of binary decision and you have a balanced range of, then great things happen to you, especially when that range is balanced and very strong. Then, you know, sometimes an ace comes and they decide you have kings, and this may seem like a specific situation. And of course it is a parlay, but when it happens, it's an absolute bonanza. So I think limp re-raising under the gun in a live game is a pretty large subject. Jacks particularly is a hand you can get in trouble with when you get called. Sometimes you're getting called by hands like queens and kings. Sometimes you're getting called by hands like sevens that will fold correctly or sometimes won't. Like, you're going to be in a bunch of tough situations after the flop if you're doing it with a narrow range that includes jacks. If you're doing it with a wider range that includes jacks, then I think I like it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like you say, there are some situations where you might want to have a particularly wide three-betting range, and then jacks kind of ends up being strong enough to do that with, just because of how wide people are raising your limp in the first place. But the really important thing to think about is, you know, why are you doing this with jacks? Like, what, as opposed to any other hand, you know, why are you doing this with jacks and not with seven deuce offsuit? And you kind of have to consider what's going to happen if you don't just win the pot immediately with your limp re-raise, which I think, I mean, Russell doesn't come right out and say this, but I think this is what a lot of people are kind of looking for, you know, because he makes this allusion to like, well, if I raise and get called in three places, then, you know, the flops are tough to play. And so people, they know that, you know, being in early position with a hand like jacks, there's going to be a lot of flops that are difficult to play. Even when they have an overpair, they're not necessarily going to be excited about stacking off with it for a lot of money. And so they're like, well, you know, it'll be easier if I just don't see a flop. And so I'll try to end the hand pre-flop and do something like this to end the hand pre-flop. And the point is, you don't need jacks to do that. Like, if you think it's going to be, like, your opponents are just going to fold often enough when you limp re-raise that you can, that's just automatically profitable, then, you know, you might as well do it with deuce seven offsuit or some other hand that, you know, so the point is, like, your cards should matter. You should like some of the situations that occur when your opponents don't fold. So I think with jacks, like, you certainly don't like getting four bet after you limp re-raise, although I think you probably have a pretty easy fold for the most part. So I also don't know how much you like getting called when you, if you limp re-raise with jacks and your opponents call, and then you get, even let's say it's a, you know, a flop where you have an overpair, 9-7 deuce rainbow, you know, how good are you going to feel about, at that point, you're going to have a low SPR, you know, you're going to end up with an SPR of like 5, and, you know, are you going to be stacking off with jacks, or are you going to be check folding jacks, or are you going to be just betting and hoping your opponent folds, at which point we're back to your card just not really mattering anymore. Yeah, I just like, I don't think you want to get it all in with jacks pre-flop. So, like, why, like, I guess the question is, why are you trying to play such a big pot with jacks? Or, you know, are you going to want to play a big pot with jacks in a majority of situations where, you know, that's going to be on the table if your opponents don't fold to your re-raise?
Yep. I like all of that. And I do think that, you know, you're right. Our correspondent, Russell, is right to be worried about playing pots out of position in multi-way pots, but that's why you tighten your range so much in the first place. Like, he's already taken this into account by not raising ace seven suited under the gun. So, like, jacks, yeah, it might be sort of nearer the bottom of an under the gun raising range, and that'll help you play well later. Like, the right response to all these possible bad situations, especially with deep stacks, like, the right response isn't to try to end the hand preflop all the time. It's to adjust your ranges appropriately. And we should be playing quite tight under the gun, 200 big blinds deep. But that doesn't mean we should be folding jacks.
Like, playing getting called by three people, I mean, you are going to win the pot less often, but that's also okay. Like, you're, if three people call your raise, you're getting 3-to-1 odds. And so, you know, winning the pot less frequently and winning larger pots when you do win, like, that's fine parlay. You know, it's okay to not win the pot every time you have jacks, or, you know, it's okay to take lines that don't, you know, maximize your chances of winning the pot. Poker isn't ultimately about winning pots. It's about making good wagers.
Let's say. Yeah, that's that was your poker isn't about winning pots music.
So yeah, I mean, I just think, like, and jacks is not a terrible hand. Like, I mean, it's hard to play as an overpair, and it's hard to play on a queen high flop. But, you know, sometimes you flop a set, which is not really true. Like, I mean, I would argue, you know, ace queen offsuit is a harder hand to play when you limp and get called in three, or when you raise and get called in three spots than jacks is when you have a lot of money behind. Because ace queen offsuit, I mean, basically never makes a hand that you want to play $1,000 pot with, at least not in a single raised pot. Whereas pocket jacks, you know, at least you have that chance to make a set and potentially make a really strong hand. And then you just kind of have to make the best of it when you don't.
Entirely.
Okay, so that's plenty of pre-flop discussion there. Although, did I cut you off? Were you about to say something?
No. I like it. I mean, we could talk about pre-flop strategy at live games. Like, that's part of what makes live poker fun, is making these adjustments, because they tend to be deeper stacked. People tend to be making all sorts of weird mistakes. Like, we could talk about this all day, and we have done so in the past. But yeah, eventually we should talk about the flop.
So well, I guess we'll give Russell's actual pre-flop action, which is that he limps in, a player in middle position limps behind. The main villain in the cutoff, who he'll give us a read on in just a second, the main villain in the cutoff raises to $30, the button calls, folds back to Russell, and he says, before I go any further, here's a few details about the players involved. The main villain in the cutoff stacks somewhere between $800 and $900, is a significantly below average 2-5 player, but he's gotten lucky a few times and built his stack up to almost $1,200 at one point, and he's seemingly eager to give it back. In fact, he's the main reason I'm still playing and haven't called it a night. He's seemingly calling preflop raises randomly. For example, I saw him call a $30 open with 9-3 offsuit in late position, calling way too frequently, but also making weirdly sized bets on flop and turn at any sign of weakness, sometimes donking as well. I've opened up my range to play hands against him a few times and had to fold to a few suspicious bets after completely whiffing flops, not really feeling like I should try to run bluffs on him when I know I can get paid off with value hands instead. Lastly, his preflop sizing has been inconsistent, and although I haven't been able to really verify this with showdown hands, I think he's making larger $30 to $45 opens with premium hands versus his typical limping or calling. So that's the player who raises to 30. The button, who calls the raise, has a similar stack size, $800 to $900, been playing much tighter, basically seems solid but fairly straightforward, don't expect him to bluff very much. So I know I said enough preflop discussion, but given the descriptions of these two players, does that make you like limp re-raising more or less?
I think less, and I think I might just call now that the first raiser has shown so much strength by raising to 30 instead of to a smaller amount. A lot of these types will raise to 20 if they have king-jack offsuit and raise to 30 with their bigger hands. And I think that the situations if we re-raise are not great. Either in his mind he's shown strength and he can get away from the hand now or later correctly, or he's, you know, or else he's got what he's representing. Like, I don't think this is going to be ace three suited as often as another raise size would. And I also think that the deception value of calling is pretty good. So given that we've already called, I think I might just limp and call here. Is that crazy?
No, that sounds right to me. And again, it comes down to that question of how are you going to like the situation if you three bet and he calls, or if you three bet and he four bets? Are you going to like the kind of spots that you end up in? And I think the answer is no. I think you kind of want to play this in a single raise pot against what is likely to be his range, or what it sounds like is likely to be his range for making it 30. And that, you know, it doesn't sound like the button is in there with too much junky stuff either. Maybe there's even a chance the button is in there with a better hand than jacks. So I don't think there's a whole lot of value in re-raising this into either of those. These two players are in this situation, unless I'm misunderstanding, you know, what he thinks the cutoff's opening range is.
Yep, I agree.
So he does 3-bet. Russell 3-bets to $125. The limper folds. The main villain calls with little hesitation. The button calls too, but he does so a bit begrudgingly, like he kind of has to call. Though he does this so obviously, Russell says that it could be a reverse tell. So I like that he's paying attention to those things. I think the button calling, the original raiser calling quickly is pretty meaningful. You know, that a lot of people, even if they're going to flat there with like kings or queens or ace, maybe even ace king, I think a lot of people will consider whether they want to re-raise with those, put in a fourth bet. So certainly aces, if he's flatting with those, he would probably consider four betting. So the fact that he didn't consider four betting is, I think, a pretty good sign and reason to think that, you know, the bigger overpairs aren't going to be out there that much. In terms of the button doing like a reverse tell, I mean, it's really hard for me to imagine the button has like aces here and just called the original raise and then overcalled a limp re-raise. That I would just be very surprised to see, especially like a straightforward 2-5 player. I mean, I think it's a bad play for anyone to do, but really doesn't sound like something that this described player would do. So, I don't think we have to worry much about better overpairs being out there based on this action and behavior.
I agree.
The flop is with 375 or so in the pot. The flop is king of hearts, queen of diamonds, jack of hearts. So our hero has flopped bottom set. There is a heart draw on the board. So this is one of those rare situations where we actually can be pretty happy with our hand after limp re-raising it. Now, you can imagine had this flop been like king, queen, nine, obviously we wouldn't be too happy. Even if the flop is 9-7 deuce rainbow, I think it matters a lot who we get the action from. I don't know that we want to put in that much money against the button on a 9-7 deuce rainbow board. The cutoff maybe seems a little spazzier, and maybe we could put stacks in against him. But just kind of assessing this now, I mean, there's 375 in the pot, there's 825 in our hero's stack. So we're looking at an SPR of well under 3. We've got a set. It's not the nuts. I'm not too worried about running into kings or queens, so I think that this is kind of functionally the third nuts on the flop. Ace 10 and 10-9 are certainly in people's ranges, but I think with an SPR this low, we should certainly be looking for ways of putting stacks in.
Yeah, and I think that the $30 raise size is very consistent with hands like ace king, ace queen, pocket jacks, which it's impossible for him to have now, but, you know, tens or nines, a hand like that. So I think that a hand like ace 10 or 10-9 suited, especially ace 10, is a bit less likely from the first raiser. The button could, I think the button will have a lot of pocket pairs, but a hand like 10-9 suited is possible for him, but a lot of other things also, including something like ace king.
Yeah, so I think to like game plan wise, we should be looking to get the money in unless the turn is a particularly bad card for us. And I certainly think that should mean betting. You know, given that we've already limp re-raised, and this is a board where, you know, probably if we're limp re-raising jacks, like surely kings and queens are in our range as well. So this is a board where I think we want to be driving the action. We shouldn't expect that our opponents are going to, you know, bet particularly wide either for value or as a bluff when checked too. So I think we really want to be doing the betting here, and you're probably just looking to bet the flop, shove the turn, unless the turn is, there's a fair number of bad turn cards, but I think for the most part, I'm going to be looking to bet flop, shove turn. That's sort of my plan when I see the flop with this SPR.
Yeah. And live players can be manipulated, but this is not a spot to think that checking is tricky. Like, you've limp re-raised. That's, you know, this is a big pot from their perspective. If you check, they're not going to decide that ace queen is good. They're just not. So, betting is, you know, checking is no more deceptive than betting is. In fact, betting makes it a bit more possible for you to have a bluff if you have that. And really just go ahead and bet.
Yeah, well said. Our hero does in fact bet. He bets $175 and he says, I was looking for a call from villain one, but very likely folding if I get raised by the button, who I would put on queens or kings or possibly 10-9 suited at that point. Ace 10 suited is also possible, but I think less likely. The main villain calls again without much thought and the button folds. So as I kind of hinted at before, I'm A, not that worried about button having queens or kings, and B, I think this pot is way too large to be looking to get away from a set. I agree that it would be worrisome if he raised. I don't know that there's a lot of worse hands that he would be raising, but you're very live against 10-9. Like, your equity against 10-9 is not terrible at all. Not that I would, you know, want to put it in if I knew for a fact that he had 10-9, but you know, maybe he has king queen, maybe he has a big diamond draw, maybe he's overplaying ace king. Like, I think there's enough of a chance to, with such a low SPR, like, you definitely should be sticking it in with jacks here. And it seems like we got close to the best possible outcome, which is getting called by the player who makes bad calls and getting the player who, you know, is pretty tight, just getting him out of there. That seems like a pretty good
outcome. Who makes bad calls and probably wouldn't have played the better hands than this preflop. The way he did. That's pretty sweet.
And the turn, with about $725 in the pot, is seven of diamonds. So at this point, stack sizes, I believe you said the villain started with somewhere between $800 and $900 and has now put in $300. So we've got an SPR lower than one, somewhere between $500 and $600 remaining in the effective stacks, $725 in the pot on the turn. I'd probably just shove here.
Yeah. If I'm not shoving, I'm doing something that's functionally the same but might be psychologically different, like...
Right.
You know, like maybe bet 400 and let them think that that's a little bit different. Yeah, but yeah, no, I'm going all in here.
Russell says, as played, I mistakenly, I think, bet $275, which is laying him proper odds to hit his draw. And he does call. At this point, I made a mental math error in my bet sizing, thinking I'm laying smaller pot odds than I actually am. Point being, I know that if I bet here, I need to go bigger than I actually did. My question, though, is should I continue betting here at all? I think against a weak player such as this, the answer is probably yes. But versus a standard 2-5 regular I typically run into on a weekday night, I'm wondering what I should do. I'm not sure I'm getting more money in at much better than 50-50 at this point. Do you think a reasonable continuing range for a solid reg would be something like ace-king of diamonds, queens, tens, jack-10 suited, 10-9 suited, and maybe ace-10 suited or queen-10 suited? Aces or kings are also possible, but I think aces folds to a sizable turn bet, if not on the flop. And I think kings generally raises... the flop, and he also acknowledges that those hands aren't super likely based on the pre-flop action. I think what's happening here is that Russell's focused a lot on the size of the pot in dollar terms and thinking like, oh, there's still a lot of money behind. There's still like $600 behind. That's 100 big blinds or more than 100 big blinds, and not so much thinking about the stack to pot ratio. So, you know, at this point, you're going to be getting better than 2-1 to put your money in. And I think it's kind of fair to ask, or it's important to ask the question, what's the alternative to shoving? Like, what else would you do other than shove? Are you going to check fold? I mean, if someone has a better hand than yours, they can put the money in. They're going to put the money in at some point. You're not going to like get away from this, I don't think. I certainly don't think you should be check folding. So even if it's true, which I don't think it is, but even if it's true that you're only going to put the money in as a 50-50 by shoving the turn, that's still better than checking and leaving it up to your opponent whether he wants to put the money in or not. This is kind of an important principle of playing out of position is... the spots you get are not going to be as good as when you're in position. But, you know, sometimes putting money in 50-50 is better than, you know, being in a gross spot if you check and he bets, or you check and he takes a free card and then the river is a diamond. There's just a lot of nasty, or sorry, the river is whatever, the flush heart. There's just a lot of like nasty things that can happen.
Yep, I agree.
I think you would certainly, go ahead.
Yeah, I also think that Russell's giving a lot of good information here, but I think he might be asking the slightly wrong question here. It sounds like, how about this? Making no comment about what Russell is saying, I think that a lot of players think in terms of questions like, oh, at Foxwoods, what do people put in $1,000 with? And I think it's useful to be a bit more situational than that. Like, I do think that $1,000 deep, I'm not sort of blithely betting 200 big blinds with bottom set on a king queen jack board because in a three bet pot, because a lot of times people are going to have queens or they're going to fold ace king or something like that. I mean, I will get it in other ways, but you know, a lot of people are, especially if they're 2-5 regs, they're going to be really hesitant about putting all that money in with one pair, and it's going to be hard for them to have two pair sometimes, etc. That said, here we had specific situational factors that made it really hard for him to have a better hand, and you know, back in the day, they used to say that the best players on Limit Poker forums were, you know, thinking about ranges in every spot, whereas the slightly less skilled players were just thinking like, oh, if I get 7-bet on the river, what do I do with the second nuts? Do I 8-bet? You know, and like, that's fine. But it's just, it's more useful to think about the situations that actually arise rather than the generalities like, do people want to get all in with unimproved aces, which is valuable, but usually a bit more usefully thought about in a specific context.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And against this particular villain, like you said, like, there might be psychological reasons or whatever to bet something less than all in, but you certainly want to be, you know, committing a lot of money. I don't actually think it's that big of a deal that our hero bet 275 or like his give. I'm not sure it's true that he's giving the villain odds to draw, especially when you factor in like reverse implied odds of hitting certain cards. And I mean, it's a little complicated here, but I don't think the hero's bet is terrible, but I would rather just stick it all in now. I think that's better than, you know, sticking it all in. Like, what are you going to do if you only bet this amount and then the river is a heart or a diamond or a 10? You know, are you check folding? Again, probably not. So you sort of just have to like stick it in.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it, and again, it matters more whether you're pricing in draws if the villain is going to have draws sometimes. And here it's pretty rare, I think, given the board texture and the preflop action. So I wouldn't beat myself up too much over the turn bet size, but I do think it's wrong. And I would just shove or do something functionally equivalent.
The villain does call, and the river is the deuce of spades. Russell says, at this point, as played, I shove for the last $350 because I believe I'll get paid by most two pair hands and maybe even ace king. I don't think I could fold if I check and he shoves anyway, so the only thing I'm costing myself at this point is not allowing him to bluff missed draws, which I'm not really sure he'd do given the size of the pot and what he has back. If he flopped the straight, he's getting paid regardless at this point. I think that's a great comment, and I think I would just say, like, I think a lot of that applies at earlier points in the hand as well. So I think it's really good on the river that he's not just thinking about better check, but he's thinking about, what am I going to do after I check? You know, am I shoving here, or am I, you know, checking and calling? Am I checking and folding? And once you frame it in those terms, I think it's a lot more obvious why you want to bet. And I think this is very good analysis and certainly the right play at this point by Russell.
Yep.
The villain ends up calling. Russell says, I flip my hand. He hesitates and then mucks. After the villain leaves, the button tells me that he folded tens on the flop. In case my point was lost to miss my rambling, my main questions are, how would you play and size the flop and turn bet, especially against a stronger player? Should I be looking to somehow keep the pot smaller by checking at some point, or does that just set myself up for getting bluffed out by a draw or someone overplaying two pair? I feel like these kinds of spots where I'm out of position and fairly deep with strong but not nutted hands have been a big leak. I often end up feeling pot committed, perhaps mistakenly, after a dangerous card hits on the turn or river. So yeah, I feel like we've addressed a lot of this already, but the bottom line is you're not that deep. You're not very deep at all, actually, by the time you see the flop in a three-way, three-bet pot. And this is really something to be thinking. Like, I think he's thinking too much about this after the flop and not enough about it before the flop. And it's sort of like you're going to get into spots like this a lot with jacks. This was actually a very favorable flop for you compared to many of the flops you could get holding jacks. And it's really the reason why you don't want to be building a pot like this by limp re-raising jacks in the first place.
Entirely agreed.
Next question, not quite a strategy hand in the same way, coming from Sam. And Sam says, do you personally use any kind of loss limit for a given session? Do you have a cap on the maximum that you will lose before going home? I know this is not consistent with thinking of each hand independently, so I'm guessing the answer is no, but I'm still curious. So I think what he means when he says, you know, thinking about each hand independently is that it doesn't actually matter like whether you win or lose on a given night. I think most people are like somewhat aware of this, but it seems like even a lot of people who are in theory aware of this still like secretly do care whether they win or lose on a given night, or like whether or not they're having a winning session. And yeah, the answer is that I don't think it should matter. I don't think it does really matter. You know, what I often like to ask people is, you know, how much did you win on what's today, August 8th, 2015. And most people can't tell me whether they won or lost or even whether they played. And so the point is, you're not going to remember. Like, I know it matters a lot to you on the given night whether or not you won or lost. And maybe then if you're keeping, you know, records of your play, which you should be, whether or not you're writing a win or a loss in that column for the session. But it doesn't actually matter long term. You know, what matters is how much you win or lose over the course of your career. And you should be able to play in such a way, like in theory, we would all be, you know, these great perfect poker robots who can just kind of keep playing well no matter how much we're winning or losing on a given night. And I think that's kind of what you should be aspiring to. However, many of us are not. And if you find that you do play badly after losing a certain amount of money, I think it's certainly a good band-aid, stopgap kind of solution to have an idea of what that amount of money is, to not bring more than that amount of money with you to the casino, or at least to be prepared to quit if you do lose that amount. I think ultimately it's kind of a mental game leak you should work on fixing, but it seems very reasonable to me to, you know, if you need to do something like this in the short term, it's certainly better than just tilting off stack after stack.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's more useful to think about like principles governing quitting. When I played in order to set up an income stream, like when my results were sort of important to me professionally or semi-professionally, there were a few criteria I would look at. One, and most importantly, was my own play. If I thought that my play was degrading, it was a good time to go home. But I also think that there's like another option available to you, which is to play a little bit differently, like tighten up and maybe miss out on a few spots, but still get most of the money at a table. This is especially true when the game is very good and you don't want to leave for that reason. And I think if you're a professional or a semi-professional, you should be capable of, if not playing your A game, at least playing your B or B plus game at all times. And playing your B plus game is an okay option, I think, in some cases. And I know that the ideal is to play your A game all the time, but when your B game can get the money, and when it's professionally important to you to get the money, then you should do that instead. I think if you're playing in a less secure environment, it's good to have a smaller stop loss and to just go home. Like, so if you get invited to a private game for the first time, and if you are just losing and losing and you don't know why, then not playing anymore is a pretty good thing to do in that case, especially if you're running into a bunch of cooler hands, or if, you know, there are other things that are fishy. So there are a few things you can do. I think super rigid stop losses are not great. And the obvious reason for that is that you can miss out on good spots. But I think in practice, the worst problem is that, like, let's say you're playing 2-5, you have a 3 buy-in stop loss and you're down 1150. A lot of people just go absolutely bananas with their last 350, figuring that they're close to their stop loss. And that can be really damaging to your bottom line. You know, missing out on the occasional pretty good game because you happen to be down 3 buy-ins already, but we're still playing okay, like, that's fine, but it's not going to, you know, that's a little bit of a problem, but it's not going to hurt you a lot over the long run. Having a 3 buy-in stop loss, which causes you to just go bananas and play terribly after you lose 2 buy-ins and lose that 3rd buy-in a lot of the time, that's the sort of thing that will cost you a lot of money over the course of a year. So I think rigid stop losses can hurt you on both sides of the stop loss, but they work for some people, so that's great. I think, as usual, a lot of self-examination is in order, and you should make situational decisions.
That's interesting. I hadn't really considered that point about the potential downside of it. But yeah, I'm sure you're right that that's a problem for a lot of people.
But you have played live poker. I mean, you've seen people after they... I think a lot of people don't think in terms of stop losses because a lot of people are not pros. But like, you've seen how people play when they buy in for 2,000 and they're down to 500, right?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, you have anything to add?
I think that was interesting. That was more illuminating for me than I kind of thought. I was just doing a service for Sam and a few other people in mentioning this, but you actually said some stuff I wasn't expecting to hear. So yeah, that was very interesting.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. So is there anything else you'd like to talk about in this special? And by special, I mean almost completely unedited episode.
I don't know. I mean, I'm,
How's life? How are you? I mean, okay, we're done with strategy. Turn off the show if you don't want to hear about how Andrew's doing. But we didn't really do much personal talk stuff at the beginning. So how are you, Andrew?
I'm good. So this is actually, people are going to hear this in a weird order because we recorded something. So like, you know, you and I have both moved since the World Series of Poker. You know, my girlfriend and I left our apartment in San Francisco, and we have already recorded an episode when I was in Lake Tahoe in California, and people are going to hear that after this one because of some technical issues that we had, or hopefully they're going to, I guess they'll hear it one way or the other, but hopefully they're going to hear the entire episode. So now that whole trip is over. Like, we spent 2 weeks traveling in California and Oregon and a touch in Nevada. We were in Reno, although I played a little bit at the Peppermill, but the biggest game they had was 3-5, so I didn't play a whole lot. It was a cool trip. We went to a couple of like national parks we hadn't been to, or Crater Lake anyway, which we hadn't been to. I have a cousin who lives in Bend, so we got to visit her and her daughter. Just got back to Maryland pretty recently, and I got to see the farm kids who I've mentioned on the show before. This was slightly interesting. We've talked about like kids playing games, and that kind of stuff. I even talked about, you know, trying to teach poker to these specific kids before. So it was the birthday of the one who's now 7, the middle kid, Oliver. And, he and his, well, both of the brothers, they're really into Pokemon cards now, which I didn't really have much experience. I was, I think, a little too old for these when they came out, or anyway, I wasn't into them when they came out. Have you played Pokemon, or do you know much about it?
I think I also missed out on this. Yeah, I knew some people who played, but I have never played any Pokemon-related game, including Pokemon Go.
So these guys are, like, super into it. That's, like, all the rage at this house is Pokemon. Like, even the little one who's only 3 and doesn't really understand, like, what it is or how it works, still just, like, likes looking at the pictures and, like, saying the names of the characters and everything. So they're super into it. And the older ones, I guess, do actually know the rules for playing and are kind of playing. So there's I think 11 and 7 is their ages, or maybe 10 and a half and 7. And I was really impressed with some of the thinking. It was interesting, first off, because they had different victory conditions. So the 7-year-old, it was his birthday, he had just gotten some new cards, and it was clear that like his victory condition was just getting to use his new cards and getting to like trigger their abilities, which I guess involves like kind of like playing out over a couple of turns, like planning out how you're going to do it and then getting to use the abilities of his new cards. So that was like what he wanted more so than winning. And the older one wanted to win, and I thought this was particularly clever that he knew what the younger one's newest cards were, and it kind of anticipated, like, knowing that he was going to want to use those, he changed up his own deck to kind of take advantage. It's essentially just like second level thinking, where he was like, I know he's going to want to use those cards, so I'm going to, you know, sort of preempt that with strategy. I just thought that was a clever thing that, you know, we do see that kind of thinking showing up in poker, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely.
How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, speaking of Pokemon, I don't play Pokemon Go, but my life has been affected by it because I live near some parks, and those parks, and I walk my dog a lot. And when I walk my dog in the parks, there are a lot of people playing Pokemon Go there, even at night. And on the one hand, those people are annoying sometimes, but they also act as a sort of unintentional security force sometimes. So yeah, Pokemon Go, making Cambridge safer since, roughly the main event. No, things are good. Things are good. I live in a new place. I am, you know, doing my things, and back from Las Vegas, so not nearly soon enough to want to go back yet. So, like, I had a great trip, but I'm also really appreciating the real world.
Nice.
Yeah, and so I owe you some thanks. You've been really good about getting guests together since you've gotten back from vacation, and I was running around a little bit. So thanks for recording this very special, less edited episode with me.
My pleasure.
Take care.
And thanks everyone for listening.
Yeah.